Yep, we're on. This is Podvacation 2016 live performances.
Let you introduce yourselves.
Yes.
I'm Black Glass.
Rena Jenkins. And we're doing From the Desk of N Fury, written by Sholio.
Internal shield memo to Fury Nicholas J, director. From Zhao Amber, head of records. Just a polite reminder, sir, that the shield incident reports need to be updated and are currently more than 6 months overdue. Also, employee evaluations are due at the end of the quarter, which is also the end of the 2013 fiscal year.
Internal shield memo. Oh, crap. Two records from N Fury. This is a not-so-polite reminder that I'm busy saving the fucking world, so I'll get to it in my own time. And since when do we have employee reviews anyway? And why is it my problem?
Most evaluations are done by division supervisors in coordination with HR, but the records division also needs evaluations for the division heads, as well as employees who report directly to you. At the risk of bringing up a sore subject, in the past this was handled by Agent Coulson, who also responded to most internal memos, which is why we are dealing directly with you now. The necessary form is attached.
Busy?
Sir, it's been 2 weeks, and this is a gentle reminder that we really need those forms by the end of the quarter, which is 3 days away, FYI. Employees for whom we are still missing evaluation forms include N. Romanova, M. Hill, C. Barton, and Steve Rogers.
Are you seriously telling me that Captain fucking America needs an employee evaluation? Are you shitting me?
Once again, evaluations are due by the 31st.
Annual Employee Evaluation, Form 300A. Name, Stephen G. Rogers. Code name, Captain fucking America. Supervisor, Nicholas J. Motherfucking Fury. Division, Avengers Initiative. Rank, Captain fucking America. Clearance level, 8. Performance, general conduct of duties, 10. Dependability, 10. Teamwork, 6. Leadership, 9. Prospect of career advancement. Advancement to what? What in the name of Jesus's left ass cheek do you expect me to promote Captain America to? Captain fucking Planet? Employee strengths. He's Captain motherfucking America. Areas for improvement. Could stand to be less of a mouthy little shit. Employee improvement action plan. Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. Notes. Fuck me. These forms are a waste of time, and you better believe I am bringing this up at the next division head meeting.
To Royce Catherine, subhead records division A. Okay, see attached form. May require a bit more than just running subroutine Fury Alpha, profanity removal, before filing. Please revise according to your discretion. Thanks. To Fury Nicholas J, director. I have not yet received evaluations for N. Romanova, C. Barton, or for the division heads. Evaluations are due by the 31st.
Fucking well know what I'm writing on yours. Annual Employee Evaluation, Form 300A. Name, Natalia Alianova Romanova. Code name, Black Widow. Supervisor, Nicholas J. Fury. Division, Field Operations, Avengers Initiative, Rank.
What?
Clearance level. 8. Performance. General conduct of duties. 10. Teamwork. Not. Leadership. Fucking. Prospect of career advancement.
Applicable.
Employee strengths. Do I really need to put anything here? Areas for improvement.
F.
Employee improvement action plan.
Fuck this.
Notes.
Fuck this too.
To Royce Catherine, Subhead Records Division A. Kay, you really have your work cut out with this one. Sorry. To Fury Nicholas J, Director. Experience tells me I'll regret asking this, but reviewing the references to the Avengers Initiative on the forms you've returned, I'm not actually clear on whether the Avengers not directly employed by S.H.I.E.L.D. are considered employees or not for administrative purposes. If so, I'm going to need evaluations on file for the rest of them.
Caps lock.
Mother F. Christ on a pogo stick. Do you want me to do an evaluation for Tony Stark? Are you people fucking high down there? Actually, I take that back. I'll be happy to do one for Stark. It's a freebie, because I'm nice like that.
Annual Employee Evaluation Form 300A. Name, Anthony Stark. Code name, Enormous Iron Plated Pain in My Ass. Supervisor. Pepper Potts. Division. Avengers Initiative. Rank. Human Disaster. Clearance level. Not applicable. Performance. General conduct of duties. 1. Teamwork. -1,000,000. Leadership. 3. Yes, I'll give him that. Prospect of career advancement. Employee strengths? None. Areas for improvement. His whole goddamn life. Employee improvement action plan. Not fucking likely. Notes. Happy face!
To Fury Nicholas J, Director. Upon reflection, Records does not need evaluation forms for any employees who don't collect a S.H.I.E.L.D. paycheck.
Good to see we're on the same page. Happy face.
However, we do still need forms for C. Barton and M. Hill, as well as division heads and anyone with clearance level 9 or above. By the 31st. That's tomorrow, FYI.
Caps lock. God fucking damn it! Annual Employee Evaluation, Form 300A. Name, Clint Barton. Codename, Hawkeye. Division. Field Operations Avengers Initiative. Rank. Not applicable. Clearance level. 8. Performance. General conduct of duties. 10. Teamwork. 7. Leadership.
Question mark.
Prospect of career advancement.
Who makes these questions up?
Employee strengths.
Damn good agent, but don't tell him I said so.
Areas for improvement.
Weapons training in something that was state of the art more recently than 1000 BC.
Employee improvement action plan.
See above. Notes. Caps lock. Whoever designed this form is fired. Two. Records. Here's Barton's fucking waste of time form. You can do hills. Just give her all tens. Maybe 15 on the leadership one.
The scale only goes up to 10.
Caps lock. Did I fucking stutter?
To Royce Catherine, sub-head records division A. Okay. Barton and Hill's forms are attached. These ones don't need too much massaging. Hill's can be put in as is. Also, you remember when I got bumped up to division head and how I was all excited about it? God, Catherine, I need a drink so bad. Oh. To Fury Nicholas J., director. Division head evaluations need to be turned in today. And while I am aware that incident reports will be turned in when you have time and world saving takes priority, the one report we really need to file by the end of the fiscal year is the field report on the Battle of New York. All the other agent reports have been turned in. It's yours we still need.
What? Explaining myself to the WSC and to, count them, two congressional committees wasn't enough?
No. That was unprofessional. I apologize. Look, if it helps, it's for posterity. Future SHIELD agents are going to study these reports, and not only that, but it will probably all be declassified one day, and the whole world will read it. This is your chance to tell your side of the story for future generations of historians. Do you really want the World Security Council and Congress to be the only ones who control what goes into the history books? I'm not just doing this because I like to torment you.
I could almost believe that last memo was from an actual person rather than some kind of AI. You drinking down there, Joe?
Yes. Yes, I have a bottle of 20-year-old scotch, and I am drinking it because it's 11:45 p.m., and theoretically I can get all this in by midnight, but no, that's not happening, since believe it or not, out of 14 division heads, plus you, you are actually the one who came the closest to turning in everything I needed in enough time for me to actually do all the data entry, filing, etc. to make the deadline. So yes, I am drinking, sir. I have drunk a lot, and I am going to drink more. Do you want to make something out of it?
Point one, calm down. Point two, it's an arbitrary deadline, Zhao, and you fucking know it. Who's gonna care, the WSC? They don't give a shit about anything we do unless something is blowing up in a major city or otherwise likely to embarrass them in front of their taxpayers. I hope it's abundantly clear by now that I sure as hell don't give a fuck if some paperwork gets filed on time or not, provided it's not vital to some overseas agent getting their backup in time. Hill might care, but I pay her to care about things like that, so no one else has to. It's midnight. Still here?
Still fucking here, sir. And very likely to be here all night. Or until I get too drunk to type. Wanna make something of it?
I was gonna ask if you had two glasses for that scotch. There's no fucking way I can write a report on the Chitauri invasion sober. You're down in records, right?
Actually, I am in the 15th floor meeting room because I needed room to spread a year's worth of paperwork around. And it also has the most comfortable chairs. And, yes, I think I can find another glass. Actually, it's more of a coffee mug that says I Heart Arrows.
That mug better be full by the time I get there. And I'm not talking coffee. Annual Employee Evaluation, Form 300A. Name, Amber C. Zhao. Codename, not applicable. Supervisor, Maria Hill. Division. Records. Rank. Division. Head. Clearance level. 8. Performance. General conduct of duties. 9. Teamwork. 7. Leadership. 8. Prospect of career advancement. 10. Employee strengths. Conscientious. Attentive to detail. Areas for improvement. Unbend a little. Remove stick from ass. Employee improvement action plan. Stick removal prospects seem good. Notes. See Hill about possible upgrade to level 9 clearance. Next year, bring 2 bottles.
The end.
So this story is Drunk Historians Through the Centuries by Stories for Travelers. Thucydides. It all started because the Athenians thought they were hot shit. The Athenians were like, oh, we're the richest. We're in charge of the fucking Delian League. We won the Persian Wars, and people thought the Persians were so fucking unbeatable. And we fucking won. And now we have an empire, and we're Athens, and everyone wants to come to Athens, and we fucking own everybody. So pay us tribute, motherfuckers. That's how it started. Because the Athenians had their heads up their asses. No, don't look at me like that. I'm from Athens, okay? I'm allowed to say it. Fucking Athens. So then Sparta, right? You know those Spartans. They're fucking psychopaths. And so Athens is all, I'm the hottest shit around. And Spartans are like, are you fucking kidding me? We make our fucking 5-year-olds fight fucking wolves and shit. Like, we're the badasses. Fucking Athens with your fucking democracy and art and philosophy and shit. Who fucking cares? We're fucking Sparta, you know? No, it's not. It's like, everyone likes to talk shit about how Sparta is so fucking great now. That's not what I'm saying. They were both motherfuckers. But like, Athens was worse. But you know those fucking Spartans only train so hard because they're fucking terrified of the Helots. They just fucking kill defenseless slave farmers all fucking day. That's their fucking training. The fuck, right? But whatever. This Peloponnesian shit was on Athens. Like, first it went okay, but then Athens started losing and shit. And war, maybe you didn't know, is fucking expensive. So they're losing and they're using up their money, and even Athenians aren't fucking happy. And Athens, they were just acting like dicks the whole time. Like, hey, a tiny number of rich dudes in your city wanted to side with Sparta? Fine, we'll kill your whole fucking city. Like, that shit. All the time. Bunch of dicks. What? No, man, I know what I'm talking about. I used to be a fucking Athenian general. Yeah, I was fired, so what? That's why I'm so fucking objective. Next is anonymous female bard singer, early Tang Dynasty, China. Okay, here's the deal. Mulan is sitting at home being a girl, and suddenly it's like, war! And everyone's, oh shit! And Mulan's like, I got this. And she swaggers out in her father's armor and just like kicks everyone in the balls. Not literally, but she's so good. She kicks ass so much. And everyone's like on the floor like, oh shit, that guy just kicked their ass. But it wasn't a guy. It was fucking Mulan. Hell yeah. She was like, hey, I have these tits and I am beating you fuckers down. Like, whoa. Like, not with her boobs though, like I'm doing, with her sword. And get this, she met this other badass lady called Shan Yang, and they were like, hey, you like destroying your fucking enemies too? We have like so much in common. And they kicked ass together for a long time. They fucking rock that shit. And then Mulan was so great that everyone wanted to say, hey, let's reward you for your like amazing service because you're so amazing, Mulan. But Mulan was like, no, that's okay. I'm fucking tired of this shit. I'm fucking just going home now. So she did, But the nation will never forget how she, like, won at winning. Anonymous male bard singer, early Middle Ages England. So King Arthur sits with all his knights at the table, and he looks around and is like, hey, one of you assholes is fucking my wife. And the knights just look at each other like, oh shit, shit's about to go down. Who's fucking the king's wife, right? And Lancelot stands up and is like, sorry, man, I fucked your wife. And she liked it, but sorry, your, you know, majesty. And Arthur is like, okay, you're like one of my favorite knights in Lancelot, but I kind of feel like that's not okay to fuck my wife. Like, it's treason and shit because I'm the king. Plus, we're friends, so that's really not cool. I kind of want to fight you right now. Okay, if you want to fight, I'll fight because I have honor and shit. But, like, I'm your knight. I'm the guy you send when you want to kill people, and shit's too fucking real to go kill the people yourself. Just saying. But you're my friend, and you're a really fucking good king. But I'm a fucking knight, you know? And Arthur was like, yeah, that's right. I'm just some king dude. Lancelot could, like, kick my ass. And Arthur was so mad that he, like, pulled out his sword and just chopped off pieces of the table. Like, he was hacking off chunks of wood, like, here and there and here and there, like, on and on. And when he was done, it was like, he chopped off so much shit from the table that, like, nobody could even find the corners of the table anymore. And that, good sirs, is why King Arthur's table was round. What do you mean that's not the story? Whatever, go fuck a wild boar. Robert Louis Stevenson. So the Jacobites, super exciting stuff, yeah. It was James II who was Catholic, and they went to restore his throne, and they were like, the Stuarts, like, hey, we're in exile. And then Scotland was like, whoa, let's do something. And we like the Stuarts, well, some of Scotland was, I think. And there were other supporters as well, lots of supporters in lots of places. And then they were like, hey, Parliament, you can't just do whatever you want and whoever you want and put them as king, no way. And also there was recusancy and the White Rose and the clan system was all, ah! And there were Anglicans and Catholics and dissenters and Whigs and Tories and divine right in France and Spunkling and Hanoverians and bishops in Spain and the 15 and the excise scheme and the 45 and, what? No, I'm not drunk. I just took a lot of cocaine instead. I didn't realize I was supposed to just be drunk. Sorry. The end. And on that note, I gotta go. So.
Okay, so, I'm Bessie Boo, and I am reading Rising to the Occasion, The Way Bros Meet, The Food Network Challenge. You didn't look at the program, did you? This was written by Rena Jenkins in Twitter fic. All right. Damn you, Food Network! Now I want to read a random pastry chef say you. Possibly where the Waybros are a team for a Food Network challenge. Because Gerard would totally have grand conceptual ideas about, like, what his cakes would look like, and he'd have super crazy elaborate pre-cake drawings, but it'd be up to Mikey to do the actual basics, like baking the, or like biking the sheet cakes that will turn into Gerard's imagined masterpieces. I meant baking, not biking. No bikes in the kitchen. And then there'd be the intense drama moment where we're not sure if the cake would be finished by the three-hour deadline, and maybe Gerard had decided to scrap his original concept an hour into the competition, and Mikey's like, grrr, eyebrows. But he loves his brother, so he does what he can to salvage the sheet cake he's already made and make a whole bunch more cakes and tries to stretch their decorating supplies to fit into Gerard's grand new design. Lots of colors, crazy shapes. You eat with your eyes first, Mikey. We want the judges to be eating our cake before they even slice it, Mikey. Possibly he rigs up a dry ice fog machine to the base of their cake for atmosphere.
Anyway, Mikey's trying to super hard to meet Gerard's vision of this cake. Is it the Halloween challenge? Or the engagement challenge? Or a music challenge? But seriously, Gerard, we only have 2 hours left and our cake is only one sheet tall. There is a height requirement. And meanwhile, the annoying host is poking her mic in Mikey's face, and he's trimming the sheet cake, and Mikey's thinking, go away, I have a knife in my hand, this is delicate work, do you want me to slice you? But he doesn't want to screw up his brother's chances of winning by sassing the host or pissing off the judges, so he just eyebrows at her and gets back to trying to carve a parade of skeletons for G. Meanwhile, Gerard is sculpting zombies and werewolves and corpses and flowers all out of Rice Krispies and modeling chocolate, letting his art school training show. He totally went to art school and took pottery/sculpture at Queens College, but then he transferred to the CIA when he realized that even though he loved making art, Gerard loved it even more when he got to see people's reactions to his creations. And though he got those reactions once every semester in art school, he loved it even more when he... Oh, wait. Nope. Yep, there we go. He could have the same experience every day in the culinary world. And the whole time, he's rambling to Mikey about his concept for this black parade that's going on. Part of it's an homage to the monster movies of his child and slasher flicks of their childhood. But part of it is also in honor of their grandmother. And then a third part is about how you don't always have to see romance and life the same way as everybody else. You need to open your eyes, Mikey. Just because it's macabre doesn't mean there isn't meaning. And he's seeing it so earnestly to the host, but she's making faces at the gore and in the werewolf's jaws. It's made up of cut up jelly bean guts. Gerard's really proud of the effect. And of course, Mikey can see a little bit of what their competitors are working on out of the corner of his eye. He doesn't have enough time to stop baking and gawk. And of course, the other two teams are going traditional and safe. They've got loads of pink and red. Well, all right, G's got a lot of red in his design too. But the others have far fewer head wounds. And Mikey thinks he actually sees a heart made of roses on one table. Ugh, how stereotypical. But what if the judges want a reinterpretation of the cliche? What if G's vision is too out there for the judges to really understand? G works so hard and he's an amazing artist. And he gets a lot of flack from food critics who think his bakery is too emo to serve worthy pastries. Mikey has faith in his brother, though. So they work on their cake, and they're a well-oiled machine, and that old trick from when they were kids of talking with their eyebrows gets used a lot more in the next 2 hours than it has been in the past few years. Because Mikey helps out in the ovens and stoves part of G's bakery, he doesn't do man the counter, ring the cash register stuff. Something about his lack of facial expressions, Bob told him once. Bob is their accountant. It's a really good thing he takes care of their books, because there's a reason neither Wei went to business school. And so he doesn't actually see G when he's in the front part of the shop, but their parade is coming along really well. Except what about the height requirement? They need at least one part of the cake to be 3 feet tall. And so far they've got 6 floats with skeletons and werewolves and corpses and vampires and roses and skulls, but that's all pretty flat. What will make the cake tall? Then G has another idea. What makes a parade awesome? Think of the Macy's parade, Mikey. We need balloons. But, well, it's a dead people parade. And also, remember the challenge, G. It's gotta have romance in it. So they don't do an inflated cartoon balloon, but G takes a lump of Rice Krispie treat, covers it in red fondant and brown modeling chocolate, and somehow, with just 15 minutes left on the clock, he makes a realistic human heart hot air balloon tethered to one of the parade's floats by way of armature wire, and it makes their cake just tall enough. There are sighs of relief from G and Mikey, comments from the host about creativity and interpretation, and still 3 minutes left on the clock. Phew. The last hurdle to overcome, of course, is the task of moving the cake to the judging table. This is made more difficult because while neither Gerard nor Mikey are quite as noodle-armed as they were in high school, baking shit and lifting 15-pound sacks of flour every day will do wonders for one's shoulder definition. They are still not exactly buff, but that's all right. They take things slow, lift with their legs and not their backs, and keep counting to three before every step. And then the cake is in front of the judges, and they didn't lose their single point of 3 feet tallness. Ha! The team making the rose hearts, good piping technique, lackluster interpretation of the prompt, Mikey thinks, had the misfortune of their armature collapsing as they transported their cake. Mikey knows he shouldn't take joy in others' misfortune, but that's the first step towards terrible karma. But he's actually really relieved that the competition has been essentially narrowed down to two. And then G goes to turn on the fog machine, and there's a moment of heart-stopping false starts, which would be appropriate, Mikey thinks, if there wasn't 10 grand on the line right now. But it works! And yeah, Mikey might be a little biased. He did just spend 3 hours making this monstrosity, but he thinks the cake is pretty kick-ass. At the judges' table, at first they get some pretty skeptical looks. The judges aren't sure what G's parade of dead people has to do with romance at all, but then Gerard gets in front of the camera and lets it roll. He talks about life and death and finding the moments where you really live and celebrate those moments. And then he points to the lead skeletal figure in front of the parade and talks about how life is worth living. And of course the judges are swayed by his wide-eyed fervent belief. They even get some high praise on their sculptural technique. However, the challenge brings a surprise twist in the last minutes. Bullshit, Mikey thinks. And it turns out that the judges are not actually the ones picking the winning cake, but some guy who wants to propose to his socialite girlfriend on television. And of course, he has no imagination and goes for the traditional cake, so Mikey and G are not the recipients of a giant check or $10,000. Which, you know, sucks. But their little bakery gains critical acclaim and a whole lot of free advertising thanks to being on the show. And some exec from Food Network even talks to G about how they're doing a Halloween special this year. And would G like to put together something for a segment? And yeah, the extra 10 grand would have been really nice, but it's not like they can't put their names up for the next challenge, right? And their little bakery actually gets such a boost in customers, thanks to G's passion on screen, that eventually they end up hiring another guy for making only cupcakes, a short, tattooed fellow Jersey boy who Gerard falls head over heels in lust and then love, complete with flirting via baked goods. But that's another story altogether. The end. Phew! Wipes brow. I'm not entirely sure what just happened there, but I missed an entire episode of Triple D to write that.
All right, this is The Theory and Practice of Fairy Godmothering, discussed in an appropriate environment, namely, over tea, by L. Stop Lador, read by Argentum Lupin. It was 4:30 on a Thursday afternoon, midwinter dark. Outside the tea shop, the wind howled and the snowdrifts were building. Inside, it was business, or rather, leisure, as usual. "So how many of yours are orphans?" The lilac fairy fanned her tea gently with her right wing. 90% at a guess, said the godmother-in-chief. "And the parents of half the others are inadequate, neglectful, to say the least. The Hardups, for example. I don't believe a word of what they say about stepmothers, by the way. I've known some fantastic ones. But their stepdaughters aren't the ones who need fairy godmothers. Anyway, appalling as Baroness Hardup is, the good Baron really should have told her that he had a daughter before they married. Still, I wouldn't say that ours is entirely a parental role." "Well, hardly," Lilac agreed. "We show up at the christening, bestowing expensive and symbolic gifts, and then flutter off until the girls hit 16, or real life, whichever comes sooner, at which point we step in to sort out whatever mess they've got themselves into, or send them out into the uncharted waters of matrimony, as appropriate." "Apart from Sugar Plum, of course. How old was that one she brought along to the party this week?" "Clara? She's 8, said a sweet, if currently rather acid, voice behind them. The two godmothers spun around. "My dear Plum, we were just talking about you, and how you spoil your girls rotten," Lilac explained with an apologetic grimace. "Well, the poor things, they might as well enjoy themselves while they're young. Dance like nobody's watching, sing like nobody's listening, eat like there's no tomorrow, and all that. How long until they come up against the patriarchy and calorie counting? If I can give them a couple of nights away from all that, well, why not? But you ought to help them learn their responsibilities, Lilac said, worried. The godmother-in-chief shook her head. Plum has a point, and she doesn't even do princesses. Youth doesn't last long. But then you have a point, too. The sparkly tiaras are all very well, but sooner or later your girl is going to have to rule the kingdom while her spouse is off slaughtering the invading hordes, or whatever. And she's going to have to know how many beans make five, as it were. But, by Grimm and Anderson, it's tempting to let them have their fun while they can. Lilac looked at her in some surprise. I thought you were the hardcore no-contact-until-time-of-dire-need sort. Well, I used to be. Now that I'm getting on for my 790th birthday, I'm mellowing. All the same, I think my reputation has been exaggerated. Just a little. Even Cinderella wasn't as surprised to see me as the media made out. Sugarplum laughed. Don't get me wrong, ladies. I can see the temptations of the delayed grand entrance. I want Clara to get used to me, so that when it comes to the difficult stuff, she won't worry too much. She'll have learned to trust in a benevolent universe. There are arguments in favor of that approach, Lilac said, in a tone that suggested she didn't think much of them. Lighten up, Lilac, the godmother-in-chief said. Just because you didn't see your charge for 116 years doesn't mean we all have to do it your way. I kept an eye on Aurora. It was more that she couldn't see me being asleep and all. I was there when it mattered. I think you're probably better than I am at knowing when it really matters. Sugarplum patted her candy floss hair. Once upon a time, the godmother-in-chief said, inconsequentially, there was a princess for whom her parents threw a birthday party every year, when the winter was coldest and the night was longest. And every year her godmother came to the party, and every year she brought her the same present, one perfect pearl. Lilac sniffed. Each pearl was identical to its neighbor, flawless and regular. While the princess grew up, the king, her father, kept them safe in a box fastened tight with iron bands. When you marry, he told her, you shall wear them, and they will not be half so beautiful as you. But year after year passed, and the string of pearls grew longer, and no prince came to marry the princess. It's those pearls, the people said. Pearls stand for tears. Our princess will weep as long as she lives. Nobody had noticed that the princess had never cried. Indeed, she shed not a tear until her 20th birthday, when, to the king's delight, a prince came riding up the snowy path to the castle to claim her, for he had heard of her beauty and was seeking the girl who would be his queen. At last, my child, the king and queen said, your prince and your husband. She said nothing, but a tear dropped from her eyelashes and froze as it fell to the icy ground. What is wrong? They asked. Why do you weep? But before she could make reply, her godmother arrived. A fairy of considerable experience, she took in the situation at a glance. She swept a curtsy. She was always good at the really impressive floor-sweeping curtsies. And, having once greeted the king and queen, spoke the words that changed their daughter's destiny. Your majesties, she said, the dead of winter is an ill time for wooing and a worse time for wedding. Do not press your daughter to speak until the spring, for how can a heart melt when the land is frozen? And to the princess, she said, dance, my child, dance, but speak no words that will keep you from returning to where you stand now. There will be a time to speak, but it is not today. And with that, she was gone. The princess thought that this year her godmother had forgotten to give her the pearl, but the next day she found it in the garden, lying on a dead leaf. And she thought that now there was one day less until the spring, and another tear fell and froze in falling. She took the pearl to her father, and he locked it in the box. The next day the spring was another day nearer, and she walked again in the garden, and there again was a pearl, lying on the same dead leaf, and again a tear fell, and froze in falling. But she did not take this pearl to her father, but kept it under her pillow. Every day of that winter she wept, and every day of that winter she found another pearl, until there were as many pearls under her pillow as there were in the box. And she knew at last that, if she married the prince, kind and gentle and gallant as he was, and he really was a most unobjectionable chap, I got to know him quite well afterwards, she would wear a noose of tears around her neck forevermore. On the first day of spring, her godmother returned, which was unusual. As a rule, she only showed up for the birthday parties. But the princess was glad to see her. Oh, I can tell you. And she showed her the collection of pearls under her pillow. Her godmother nodded, as if she had been expecting this. Every year, she said, I brought you a pearl. On your first birthday, I brought you the pearl of love. On your second birthday, I brought you the pearl of laughter. On your third, the pearl of joy. On your fourth, the pearl of learning. On your fifth, the pearl of kindness. On your sixth, the pearl of common sense. Then that of gentleness, then that of wisdom, then that of grace. Then beauty, confidence, strength, and riches. Friendship, I brought you, and solitude. Courage, I brought you, and patience. On your 18th birthday, I brought you gratefulness. And, on your 19th, hope. This year, you have found the pearl of sadness for yourself, and with it, the pearl of self-knowledge. The one I could not bring myself to give you, and the other was not in my power to give you. Take them, then, and use them. They are yours. And so the princess went to the queen and said, Mother, it is the first day of spring, and I must grieve you. And she went to the king and said, Father, it is the first day of spring, and I must displease you, for I cannot marry this prince, nor any man. And now the king and queen wept, that their hopes were gone. And the queen said, Wait, my child, until the summer sun is high, and see if the blossoming flowers have not awakened love in your wintry heart. And so she waited. And on Midsummer Day she went to the queen and said, Mother, it is Midsummer Day, and I must grieve you. And she went to the king and said, Father, it is Midsummer Day, and I must displease you, for I cannot marry this prince, nor any man. And the king and queen wept again. And the king said, Wait, my child, until the leaves fall from the trees, and see if you do not wish to go to life and warmth while they can be yours. And so she waited. And when the days grew short, she went to the queen and said, Mother, it is autumn, and I must grieve you. And she went to the king and said, Father, it is autumn, and I must displease you, for I cannot marry this prince, nor any man. Now they wept, and her eyes were dry. At last the king said, Child, this was not our will for you, but if it is your will to seek happiness where we cannot conceive of its being, so be it. Go, with our blessing. But yet stay until your 21st birthday, and for these last months let us be happy. We have spent too long weeping. The king had her pearls strung, and at her 21st birthday she wore them for the first time, though if she wept, it was for happiness. She danced with the prince and bade him farewell. He asked where she was going and what she was doing, and, when she told him, he smiled, and said that, this being so, they would surely meet again. He kissed her hand and wished her well. And when midnight struck, there was her fairy godmother. This time she brought no pearl. Indeed, she brought no gift at all. But she held out her hand to the princess, and the princess stepped into her carriage, and off they went into the night. Off she went to learn, to work, to love, and to make other girls happy. And, learning that, to be happy herself. Off she went to find out and to become who she was born to be. There was a pause. Behind her, the waitress cleared her throat. The usual, ma'am, she said, and laid on the table a cake blazing with candles. A very happy birthday from all of us. In the golden light, the double string of pearls gleamed around the throat of the godmother-in-chief. How lovely, she said, and drained her teacup. You know, I flatter myself that I've made my goddaughters ever afters happier than they would have been had I not been around. But still, I'm not convinced that I didn't have the happiest ever after of them all. And she blew out her candles. The end.
Okay, so just quickly, the conceit of this story, which is a much longer story than the excerpt I'm going to read, is that Carlos from Night Vale is Carlos from the Dresden Files. They're the same character. A lot of the other information is in here. But of course, as a warden of the Western United States, one of his responsibilities happens to be Night Vale. Carlos shoves the subway grate upwards. It pops out of the ground. He pushes it to the side. He hauls himself up onto the sidewalk and rolls onto his back with a groan. For a moment, he's tempted to stay there. He made it back into town late Late last night, just in time to find a giant creature composed of the twisted, melded forms of librarians, busting through the back wall of the library by the biography section. The subsequent inferno was not entirely his fault, since he wasn't the one shooting fire from his sensilla, but maybe could have been slightly more careful with the grenades. He barely had time to shower off the ashes and eat before Andre knocked on his door, asking about the new subway. Apart from a power nap during lunch, he'd spent the rest of his day sabotaging construction, fighting off swarms of cockroaches, and having his, admittedly scanty, knowledge of DNA heckled by ungrateful nitpickers. He hasn't felt this exhausted in months. But he's not going to stay here, because he and Cecil have been dating for approximately 32 days, 1 hour and 17 minutes, local time, and tonight they are celebrating their 1 month anniversary. Cecil insists that this is not accurate, since they canceled another Wednesday, and Carlos is not going to argue with it when all his supporting data points should probably be classified as outliers. Most of the other people on the sidewalk are walking around him without even seeming to notice, but he hears someone say, "Are you okay, mister?" He turns his head and immediately calls up a fistful of entropic force, because a horrible, grinning, mummified, bug-like corpse of a face is staring at him. A few seconds too late, he realizes it's only the head of a successfully neutralized librarian, being carried by a 12-year-old Tamika Flynn. He dismisses the green light pooling in his hand. She stares down at him and then says hesitantly, "Mr. Carlos?" Carlos sighs and sits the rest of the way up. "Hi," he says. "It's Tamika, right? I work with your mom sometimes." She nods. She looks over at the displaced grate and says, "Victor Hugo said the sewer is the conscience of a city. It's where everything bears its true form." Carlos has seen the true form of things in sewers. He's felt their teeth, too. He suppresses the shudder and says, "I was actually down in the maintenance tunnels." "For the subways?" she asks. He nods. "The trains came back," she says. "Most of them." "Most of them," Carlos agrees. He rubs his face. The old litany kicks up in the back of his mind. What if I was faster? What if I was better? What if I had more time? What if, what if, what if, what if? Tamika is frowning down at her feet. "I couldn't help everyone in the summer reading program either. Sometimes I feel like you'd have to be crazy to stand up against the terrible things when you know you can't, when you know you can never stop them completely," says Carlos. "But you'd have to be crazy to stand by and let them happen." "That's a bad paraphrase, but I know what you mean," she says. Now she stares at the horizon. "I've seen the true form of the city." Carlos looks at her closely. Almost everyone in Night Vale has eyes wizened before their time. Tamika's are older than most. He wonders if the written word ever trembled beneath them. "I believe you," he says. "I'm sorry." "There's a war coming," she says. "We'll be ready. We'll make sure everyone's ready in time." The rational part of his mind tells him that she is a child who has seen more than anyone should ever have to. The rest of his mind points out that, one, that doesn't mean she's wrong, and two, he's been fighting a long, slow siege against time itself. The war, or part of it, has already come to Night Vale. "Just remember," he says, "in every war, there are some laws that you should never break." Tamika transfers her ancient gaze to him. She looks away just before a soul gaze starts and nods. She holds up her free hand and grimaces in concentration. A little jet of butter-yellow flame fixed briefly to life before disappearing. "Is that science?" asks Tamika. "I haven't read much nonfiction yet." "It all depends on how you look at it," says Carlos. "I'd like to think so, but a lot of people would disagree." Tamika stares at him some more, until suddenly she blinks and looks like a normal preteen again, albeit one carrying the mummified head of a librarian. "Don't worry," she says. "I won't tell them." "Gracias, Tamika," Carlos says. He climbs to his feet and holds out his hand. Tamika shakes it, says, "De nada." Her grip has a nice, healthy buzz of magic, a moderate talent with a lot of potential. Carlos isn't sure what his own handshake feels like, but judging by the way Tamika's still staring askance at her fingers even after he's let go, she probably registers it as slightly more than a buzz. She looks up at him and says, "Cecil was talking about you on the radio." "He does that," says Carlos. My mom says he's a nice boy, and if you hurt him... She trails off ominously. She's only 12 years old and about 6 inches shorter than him, but she pulls it off pretty well. The severed head helps. What will she do? Asks Carlos, morbidly curious. Tamika sighs and says, She won't tell me. She just trails off ominously. Carlos grins. Tell her I'll be good. And speaking of which, I've got a date, so I should be going. Are the cockroaches a gift? What? Carlos asks, alarmed. Tamika graciously helps him pick the bugs out of his hair. She's a good kid, Carlos thinks. Carlos has the whole evening planned out, sort of. He's picking Cecil up from work as soon as his show was done. And they're going out for a nice dinner at a new seafood place on Dragon Street. Cecil is getting a present Carlos definitely has not spent the last week agonizing over. And then he has no idea how to tastefully suggest they have hot one-month anniversary sex, preferably with explicit instructions, since he's never actually done this. Sorry, maybe should have mentioned that before. Carlos ruthlessly shoves any feelings of nervousness and hesitation aside, because this is a time for action. Well, romance first, then action. Hopefully. The point is, he has a rendezvous at 2000 Juliet, and he needs to move out. Carlos wonders if other people plan their dates like their ops. The first inkling that something is wrong is when he pulls up to the station, and Cecil, who is normally very punctual, is not waiting outside. Carlos drums his fingers against the steering wheel. When he turns the radio back on to see if Cecil is somehow still broadcasting, there's only the buzzing of a swarm of flies. Carlos parks and walks to the door. The only person in the front room is an intern hiding under her desk. But there are people coming down the hall. He hears Cecil's voice and relaxes. And now we are in a state of grace. It is a time of illumination and fevers, when the doors of perception have been cleansed, a high moment when we can plumb the fathoms of unseen mystery and remember that Dylan was a hard worker and pleasant company and shall be greatly missed. The two women following Cecil nod tearfully. One of them is carrying a cardboard box full of someone's, presumably intern Dylan's, office supplies. The other is clutching a station flyer on yellow paper. And should he ever return from his journey into infinite space, infinite meaning, and infinite dimension, we will be happy to offer him his previous position and comp his subway ticket. The women thank him and leave. The intern crawls out from under her desk and follows them, still crouching low. She somersaults through the open bloodstone door and disappears into the night. Hi, Cecil, says Carlos. Carlos, says Cecil, you're here. Have you considered the inherent perfection of the human nose? Not just yours, of course, everyone's. I can't say that I have, says Carlos. Our eyes cannot see the tiniest organisms or the furthest stars, and our ears turn the silent agitation of nature into metamorphosed song. But our noses remember even when we do not. It's the strangest speech Cecil has ever made, and yet he's flushed, and there's a feverish gleam in his eyes. Cecil, are you okay? Asks Carlos. I'm fine, says Cecil. I'm better than fine. For one brief moment, I knew it all, Carlos. I knew all. Of course, such transcendence is fleeting, but recall is in my grasp. Do you know how, Carlos? Do you know how? You're going to go around smelling subways, Carlos guesses. Yes! He gently places his hands on either side of Carlos's head and pulls it toward him until their foreheads are touching. The subway has been closed for construction, but all I need is one perfect mixture of compressed air, hot steel, and the faint scent of stale urine, and the mysteries of the universe will be mine once more. I think your altered mental state is impairing your executive functions, says Carlos. Oh? Says Cecil. He sounds politely interested. but is stroking the lapel of Carlos's lab coat with a somewhat worrying fascination. "Cecil," says Carlos. "Yes, Carlos? You sound really high," says Carlos. "I think you're the first person in recorded history who wants to smell the subway station." "You raise a valid point," says Cecil. He kisses Carlos once, lightly, then kisses him again with more intent. Carlos kisses him back, and wow, Cecil's hands are creeping places they don't normally go in their respective workplaces. And then Cecil says, "It can wait until after our date. It is a date, right? I don't want to presume. Any time with you is precious to me, Carlos." "I can confirm it is a date," says Carlos. Their faces are barely an inch apart. Cecil is nuzzling Carlos's nose with his own, which Carlos should probably think is hilarious, but mainly finds horrifyingly adorable. "If you take your hands out of my pants, we can get to dinner." "Dinner sounds amazing," says Cecil. Then, "Oh, I'm sorry, Carlos." Carlos's ass is ungroped. "Your nose is amazing, too," says Cecil very sincerely. "I should write it a sonnet. After dinner. My innards ache with the cavernous emptiness that haunts the deep places of the earth, doomed to sunless exile since the days when life took its first faltering steps from the primordial seas." "Have you been reading up on evolutionary theory?" says Carlos, impressed. "No, but I ate an entire box of popsicles when I got back from the subway, and that was the punchline to one of the jokes written on the sticks." Cecil hauls Carlos into a hug and buries his face in his hair. "Cecil? So hungry," mutters Cecil, but otherwise does not move. "Cecil, I don't even like poisonberry popsicles." He sighs. "Carlos? Yes? I think maybe we should get takeout instead." "That's probably a good idea," says Carlos. "Can we stop by the subway station?" "Maybe later," says Carlos.
Never did that, for the record.
Was there porn in it?
I don't know. It's a whole blur. Yeah, there's definitely not in this one. Cool, so this is Frostbite.
It's written by CJ Awkward.
And it's kind of sad because it's Lindsay. I would like to take no credit for
this. You can take soulmate credit.
I can take soulmate credit.
So the summary is, Steve Rogers never had a soulmate. The other side of his bond was empty. Tony Stark wishes his was. He just wants to stop being cold.
Yeah. Before the ice, Steve knew that he didn't have a soulmate. He had never felt the tug of another side. He had never felt the tug of the other side of the bond. He had never felt sensations that weren't his. Emotions that belonged to someone else. It wasn't uncommon back in the Depression. Sometimes soulmates died young, before a bond could form. Sometimes soulmates weren't born. His parents weren't mates, his mom would remind him. We were happy enough without a bond. "I'm glad I don't have a mate," he told Bucky one winter, around the constricting bands he felt around his chest. At least I know she ain't hurting like me." He ignored the look on Bucky's face and focused on breathing through the hacking coughs that stole the badly needed air from his lungs.
"Tony is 4 and is so very cold. It's July, and outside it's sweltering. He can see the heat waves rising from the ground when he looks outside his bedroom window. But Tony is shivering, his teeth chattering. His mama swaddles him in blankets and instructs Jarvis to light a fire, despite the heat outside. She holds him close, and Tony can feel how sweaty her forehead is against his, but he is still freezing. He appreciates the hot cocoa Jarvis brings him, though, and falls asleep on his mother's lap, freezing, feeling safe and loved, if not warm. That night, just like every night, Maria Carbonell holds her rosary beads and pleads with the saints to protect her baby boy.
Bucky gets drafted, and Steve meets Erskine, and Steve's world changes. He meets Peggy Carter, who doesn't believe in mates and doesn't care that Steve is small. Steve only met her a few weeks ago, but he thinks he might be a little in love with her. Then he gets chosen for the serum, and Erskine asks him if he has a soulmate. Steve answers him and doesn't miss the loosening of the doctor's shoulders. He wonders why until Stark's machine turns on and the screaming starts. At least he knew that no one was suffering with him.
Tony is 10 years old, and his parents are fighting. It's not uncommon. They never stop arguing nowadays, he thinks, as he shudders and pulls his blankets tighter around his shoulders. Today, it's about him. You need to stop pandering to him, Maria. He's a Stark. He's a child. Enough. I refuse to have this conversation with you again. Tony smiles greatly at Jarvis as the butler hands him the mug of cocoa. The man tucks the blankets a little tighter around his young master's shoulders before he returns to the dinner preparations. Tonight, he knows, Howard will inform Tony of the boarding school the boy had been accepted into. Unlike Mrs. Stark, Jarvis did not have the freedom to argue with Mr. Stark about his decisions. The butler resigns himself to worrying about Master Tony and his soulmate. Tony simply rubs his chest and tries to project comforting thoughts to his mate.
Bucky is holding on, his fingers wrapped around the metal, but he's slipping, and Steve can't reach, and then he's watching as his best friend falls, and wishes more than anything to go down with him. Steve wakes up to a dark and cold tent in the middle of Austria and sees the empty bedroll beside his own. His ma was long gone now, and he had just gotten his friend, his brother, killed. For the first time, he's totally alone. He takes a deep, shuddering breath in the oppressive silence of the tent, and for the first time, he curses his lack of a soulmate to help him cope with the pain.
Rhodey wraps an arm around his shuddering frame and leads him away from the graves of his parents. Obadiah stops to deal with the press, but Rhodey just keeps walking, back into the car. Inside the car, Tony finally lets tears spill down his cheeks. He feels the familiar chill in his bones, and not for the first time, curses his soulmate for not being there.
Steve is going down, and he knows, can already feel the phantom water filling his lungs. He hears Peggy's voice, stares into her eyes in the picture in his compass. He arranges a date that they both know he'll never make, and his eyes sting with tears. He could have had it all with Peggy. Marriage, kids, the American dream, the ideal his parents had immigrated from Ireland for. They might not have been soulmates, but they could have made it work. And that's why, as he goes down, he dreams of Peggy in a beautiful white dress and not some fantasy person that Steve never had the option of having.
Tony has shrapnel in his chest, and the cave is cold. He's used to cold, of course. His bones have felt as if they were made of ice for as long as he could remember. But Tony has always been coddled, wrapped in blankets by his mother, warm hugs from Rhodey that he could almost feel. Tony's soulmate might always be freezing, but Tony has never been truly cold all by himself. But the cave is dark and damp, and his chest aches, and he's attached to a goddamn battery. And, oh God, they just keep pushing him under again and again. The second time they have to perform CPR makes him feel as if he's not only has a hole in his sternum, but as if they had ripped out his heart entirely. Then he builds the first miniaturized arc reactor, and he builds the Mark I, because he knows he has to finish this, so there will be more. And he watches his first friend he made in the past decade die. And he kills his first men with his own hands. And he walks through the desert. And And for the first time, he thanks whatever deities that exist that his soulmate is perpetually cold. Because while he can feel his shoulders blistering, can feel how dry his mouth is, but he doesn't feel the heat in his core, and it keeps him going until Rhodey can wrap his arms around them and Tony knows he's safe.
Steve wakes up and his chest aches. Fury, Director Fury, and boy, if anyone ever fitted their name better, Steve sure wanted to meet them, tells him he's been asleep, and Steve realizes that the impossible happened. He has a soulmate. He wants to scream. His soulmate could be in their 60s, could have lived a whole lifetime without him, like Peggy, beautiful Peggy, who was still as gorgeous as ever, despite her frailness. She met her soulmate, she tells him, in her more lucid moments. She was right. She lived happily and bonded with a lovely-looking woman she calls Angie when she shows him the picture. And Steve's heart hurts under his soulmate's pain. His soulmate is constantly tense, his shoulders knotted, and Steve sometimes gets flickers of emotion. Mostly irritation, but sometimes he gets something he can only describe as longing. Steve wishes he was stronger. He wishes he could reach out, try to find this mystery, to give them both peace. But this person, they could have been born in 1945. They could have lived their entire life without him. They could be older, their faces lined with age that Steve is missing. He's already lost everything. He's clinging to Peggy, but he's losing her too, her memory riddled with more holes than Bucky's moth-eaten old socks. Call him selfish, but he can't lose something he's never had. I'm sorry, he thinks, and knows it isn't enough.
For the first time in his life, Tony feels truly warm. He almost doesn't know what the feeling is. As soon as he notices, he excuses himself from the board meeting to have a panic attack in the closet. It's Pepper who finds him. Pepper who whispers, "Oh, Tony." Pepper who herds him into the car where Happy takes him home. Pepper who gets him to the penthouse of his almost finished tower. And oh God, how much Tony wishes she was the one who made him feel like this. The second thing Tony does is take a steaming hot bath, pushing away memories of hands in his hair, submerging him. And for the first time, he feels something that isn't cold or numb. The third thing he does, because he can feel something, or more aptly, someone, at the edges of his consciousness, is clamp down on the connection. Hard enough, he thinks, that if this was a movie, he'd have broken it. The fourth thing Tony Stark does after he finds his soulmate is awake is cry.
Steve's chest is still aching, but he's fighting, and it almost feels like the Howling Commandos. Except the Howling Commandos never fought actual aliens, and God, Bucky would have loved this. The Avengers are becoming a team forged in fire. Thor and Banner, the Hulk, he reminds himself, are brawlers, like Dum-Dum, and seem to be enjoying themselves. Barton is a sniper, like Bucky, and he's up high, making snarky comments, and he thinks of Gabe. Romanov, well, she reminds him of Peggy. He thinks she's more like Marita, using her body as a weapon. And Stark is flying, and if this is the future, Steve is glad to witness it. But then the warhead is aimed at Manhattan, and Stark is riding it into the portal, and Steve knows a little something about sacrifice plays, but he can't help but feel preemptive grief at the loss of another teammate. He feels a wave of something from his soulmate, a deliberate, if brief, contact, for the first time ever. He's so startled that he barely recognizes the feeling of apology, and he doesn't get... It's only when the pain in his chest worsens suddenly, then gradually lessens, until all he feels is empty, that Steve realizes. He's lost something he never had.
Hulk shocking his heart back, a team dinner and a demigod in chains later, Tony Stark faces his soulmate for the first time without being under the influence of some crazy guy's magic stick. Steve Rogers. Explains the cold, I suppose, he states flippantly, and winces when the other man almost imperceptibly flinches.
At least I know you haven't got an age-related heart problem.
Oh, was that sass? Tony thinks he likes the good captain a bit better if the man is willing to sass him.
And I think we should start over.
Excuse me?
We weren't exactly introduced in the best of circumstances.
At this, Roger sticks his hand out.
Hi, I'm Steve Rogers.
Tony smirks and says, Tony Stark, you're only 38 years late, and goes to shake the other man's hand. Their hands meet, and the bond flares up, bright, beautiful, and warm.
The end.
Okay, this is Carcat Vantis's Guide to Safe Sex with Aliens. Carcat is an alien, by the way. It is written by Mercurial Malcontent. Carcat Vantis's Guide to Safe Sex with Aliens, or How to Get Your Freak On with Freaks Without Embarrassing Yourself in Every Way Possible. Reading this memo is mandatory. It has recently come to my attention that interspecies relations are rapidly devolving into sloppy makeouts that threaten to become disgustingly more intimate in an effort to keep you idiots from freaking the fuck out over weird xenobiology and embarrassing everyone in the worst ways possible. I have compiled a guide, which should be short enough that even those of you with the attention spans of small insects should be able to read it all in one sitting. Did I mention that reading this guide is mandatory? Because it is! Even for you, Equius. I don't care if you have to alchemize a million shitty towels to deal with it. Base guidelines. 1. Keep your cool. I don't give a fuck how weird you think some part of someone else is. Shrieking and running away leads to mortification. Not the least of all, mine, when I have to comfort the goddamn blubbering pansy you left behind. 2. Keep your hands to yourself. If you're not Think Pan damaged wigglers, there is no reason for you not to put your windholes to the function of using your fucking words before you get your grubby nubs all over someone else's body parts, no matter how innocent those body parts may seem to be. This means no more repeats of last week's horn molestation incident, Strider. 3. Keep it private. Nobody wants to hear your gross cutesy names or watch you humping on the couch. And if you're into voyeurism, that's your own fucking problem. Most especially, no one fucking wants to know what fluids seeped from your carcasses because you left stains on the sofa. All right, now for the sordid details. Again, because you morons never listen the first time, I expect you to read this entire thing, because God knows some of you don't have more than half a clue about your own bodies, much less anyone else's. Troll sexual biology. 1. Yes, the horns are a thing. For some of us more than others, I know they're right there out in the open, being oh so tempting. But you don't fucking touch unless you asked or are asked. And you'd better be prepared to be a goddamn gentleman and get the other person off. 2. Yes, we have chest nubs too. No, I don't know why, so stop asking. No, you cannot touch without asking any more than you can with our horns. What is wrong with you? 3. Bulges and nooks. Learn them and love them, because we've all got them. 4. All of our bodily secretions are tinted our blood color. Even that one. 5. Don't ask about pails. This means you, John Egbert. They are not hot, exciting, or even interesting. They are a fetishized object of our dead culture that most of us would rather forget, because being reminded of the drones is an instant mood killer, if not a weeks-long boner kill. Human sexual biology. 1. That indentation on human abdomens is not an orifice of any sort. Much less a sexual one. That doesn't mean you can prod it with your frond without asking, because what did I fucking say about keeping your hands to yourself? 2. Humans are sexually dimorphous. Humans are sexually dimorphous below the belt. So don't go undressing one expecting to see the same equipment as you have. They pretty much get either a bulge or a nook. And if that's going to be a huge disappointment, ask before you undress. 3. Nook-equipped humans have a nub where a bulge would be. No, it won't telescope out, no matter how much you ask. 4. If you just can't get over your human fuck buddy not having something to thrust up your nook, alchemize a shame stick and deal with it. Because your sexual hang-ups are not my goddamn jurisdiction. 5. If you can't get over your human fuck buddy not having a nook for you to thrust up into, you'd better goddamn well ask if you get the bright idea to stick your bulge into any of their other orifices. Yes, Vriska, I heard about what happened last Tuesday. 6. Bulge-equipped humans have this sack dangling behind their bulges. For the love of God, don't squeeze it! Hopefully, now that you've read this guide, you get the gist of it enough to avoid doing serious physical or mental harm to yourself or others. If you have any questions, reread this guide until you figure it out yourself, because I have already heard way too much about the intimate details of your relationships and am now scarred for life. Nice going, assholes. The end.
Text from Cephalopods, an audio comedy written by Volta Aerovet. Readers shall be
Revolutionary Joe,
Lunate 8,
Bessie Boo,
and Raina Jenkins.
Text from Cephalopods. It is a well-established fact in marine biology that the octopus is the drunk texter of the cephalopod family. Part 1. Octopus hassles his beleaguered friend, the squid. Phone ID. Squid. LOL.
Hey, squid, guess what?
Whale text balloon.
I'm a whale! JK, I'm an octopus. LOL.
I have no idea why I haven't blocked your number yet.
Part 2. Octopus takes an interest in cinematography. An octopus rests in a patch of seaweed on the ocean floor. One of its tentacles reaches towards the camera. Suddenly, the view becomes erratic and shaky with glimpses of the octopus, a human diver, and the sea floor. The image stabilizes, showing various close-ups of the octopus's body and suction cups. and then becomes wildly disorienting again. The same diver now has a spear gun, and the octopus wraps itself around the end of it. The octopus maintains its grip on the spear gun as it is carried through the water.
Hey, guess what? Squid. Squid.
What is it?
I got this guy's camera, lol.
You got what?
Let me send you a pic.
Blurry picture of a tentacle. Blurry picture of two fingers.
Okay, here goes.
You got your tentacle in front of the lens. You got all eight tentacles in front of the lens. How is that even possible?
Hey, don't front. My camera is awesome.
Uh-oh, GGG, this guy's still after me. Octopus? Are you okay? Octopus?
Running, 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 oh my god, running! Hey, Squid, guess what now?
Let me guess, you stole another piece of human electronics.
What? No, cameras are lame. We did a trade. I got a harpoon now.
A what?
Yarr, Warby the White Whale.
Part 3. Octopus finds a sturdy boat. Many different octopuses, with one or two coconut shell halves, are individually observed on the seafloor. Some carry a shell beneath them as they scuttle along the sand. Others hide under the shell or encase themselves in two halves.
Hey, Squid, check it! I got this awesome thing!
Why do you have a coconut shell? Wait. How did you get a coconut shell? Never mind. I get the feeling that will only invite overdone Monty Python references.
What's Monty Python?
I can't believe I talked to you.
Lol, I'm a hermit crab.
Picture of an octopus resting in two coconut shell halves.
JK, I'm an octopus, lol.
Okay, back to the first question. Why do you have a coconut shell?
It's my hyssop. Hyssop. Ship. Okay, I'm off to pillage and stuff.
Have fun with that.
Yarr, hoist the mizzenmast, scrub the poop deck, raise the anchors! Away!
Part 4. Octopus pillages a passing ship. An octopus moves slowly along the deck of a shrimp boat. The booted feet of the crew are visible as the octopus inches along until finally falling over the deck and into the water.
I'm in your hyssop eating your foods, lol.
Ship. What ship?
Oh, you know, the one with the trampolines and... Hang on.
You mean fishing ship? We've talked about those. This is a terrible idea. This is an extremely terrible idea. Where are you?
On the deck where all the prawns are. Oh my god, this is so awesome. You have no idea.
The deck? Hang on, stay right where you are. Or, no, don't stay right where you are.
No, it's cool, man. I got this under control. I'm like one with the scenery, Tam. I am a being of solitude. You can't see me.
Oh my god.
Ate all the prawns. Super tasty.
Good. Now you can get out. Yes?
And I got the greatest idea ever. What if I ate all their meat too, lol? And the humans were all
humans?
How did you get in here?
You interacted with humans?
And I was all, excuse me, gents, I have places to be. P.S. Thanks for the prawns and bait, lol.
Nobody but you could pull that off, Octopus. Nobody but you.
Part 5. Octopus shares his spoils. An octopus emerges from a tidal pool and starts to make its way across the semi-dry land. Tourists marvel and comment as the octopus continues to move along amidst damp seaweed. The octopus stops, releases the crab shell it had been carrying, then crawls back to the tidal pool.
Oh my god, there's people over there! I'm gonna go give them a crab, lol.
Wait, people? People? People are who invented calamari, Octopus. Calamari!
Well, they were all like, oh no, it's an octopus, back away! And I was all like, hello, humans! I have come to give you food as a gift from my people! May our people live forever in peace, lol! And then I return to the sea, leaving them in bounty. Building bridges, my friend. Building bridges.
You are a credit to our kind, Octopus.
Part 6. Squid worries about what has happened to Octopus. With special guest star, the angry cuttlefish. A cuttlefish swims along, then suddenly pulls away as a nearby smaller fish bumps into it. The cuttlefish pauses, small spikes start appearing on its body, and slowly approaches the camera. Phone ID, idiot octopus.
Hey octopus, are you okay? I haven't heard from you in a while. Octopus?
2 hours later.
Octopus, if you get this, please let me know you are not dead. I understand we have had our differences, you having 8 legs and me having 10. Which is not a commentary on your intelligence in any way. But I guess what I mean is, I very much hope you haven't crawled into a hole and died. So if you get this message, please let me know that you are not dead.
30 minutes later.
Octopus?
15 minutes later. Phone ID. Cuttlefish.
Sorry to bother you, cuttlefish.
Yeah, what do you want?
I could ask you a question.
Hang on. Let me consult my sisters. All 8 million of them. So we can drop whatever it is we are doing and immediately help you with whatever it is you need. Right now.
I was wondering if you had seen our friend Octopus anywhere?
Oh, that fucker? Yeah, he's in the aquarium now. Why?
The what?
Seven. Octopus enjoys his new home. In an aquarium display, an octopus covers the top of a lidded glass jar that contains a live crab. The octopus repeatedly adjusts its body around the lid until it's loose enough to fit a tentacle inside. Moving the lid out of the way, the octopus inserts more tentacles into the jar and surrounds the crab. After a few moments, the octopus pulls itself and the crab out of the jar.
Hey, Squid, can you look something up for me?
Are you okay?
Yeah, this place is great. So, can you go on Game FAQs and look up how to open a jar with a crab in it? I got the last one, but I'm kind of stuck on this one. No, wait, I got it!
I'm so thrilled.
Okay, so go on Game FAQs and log into my account. Name Octolol248, password 123456. Update my jar walkthrough with this. Hold glass thing. Turn green round thing left, like 4 times. Remove crab. Eat the heck out of it. Oh, hey, I just got this great idea. I was looking at this jar and I thought, could I fit inside it?
This sounds like a generally bad idea to me.
Don't dare me to do it, man. I'll totally do it.
I said this sounds like a bad idea.
Phone ID. Fucking Squid.
Tell him to do it. We want to see if he can.
Picture of an octopus in an open jar underwater. Part 8. Octopus knows nothing about soccer. An octopus sits in a tank with a soccer ball and 2 clear boxes, one featuring Germany's flag and the other Spain's. People talk and take pictures as the octopus perches on top of the box containing Spain's flag.
Hey Squid, what do you know about soccer?
I know a bit about the old football. Why do you ask?
Okay, great. I said soccer, but what else? Quick, Germany versus Spain. Who will win?
That's pretty tough. Villa's one of the top players out there.
Yeah?
But Germany's got a fantastic overall lineup. Really, no holes there. If Spain can manage to hang together and support their star players, maybe. But otherwise, I'd definitely go with Germany. It's going to be a good match. I'm kind of sorry it's happening so early. Anyway, Germany.
Never mind, I'm going with Spain.
What? Why?
Because Cuttlefish said it'd be hilarious to go swim up in front of them and be like, sorry, Germany. Thanks for the fish, but you're out. Lol.
Phone ID. Cuttlefish.
You have no honor.
Whatever, man. Rugby's where it's at.
No honor. None.
Part 9. Octopus enacts another daring escape. Sort of. As a number of small children watch, an octopus moves from one aquarium display tank to an adjacent one by squeezing through a small opening in the partition between tanks.
Dun, 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 dun.
What are you doing?
Mission Impossible!
I'm like totally Tom Cruise ATM.
Okay, assume I'm the idiot here. What are you doing?
I'm making a daring escape!
Great. How are you getting out?
Nah, man, I'm just going to the next tank. Tomorrow, the humans will be like...
breakfast.
And I'll be like... you go have yourself a break. I already fed myself. Lol.
Good luck with that.
Oh, man, that tank has some huge fish, BRB.
I'm a whale.
You forgot to do the period and underscore thing.
No, I'm actually a whale. The octopus somehow made it into my tank.
What?
Clever little fella. Anywho, he just wanted me to say hi. The octopus said you could show me a picture of me?
No.
Oh, come on, man, do it!
Fine.
Whale text balloon.
Oh, that's quite the clever picture.
I just, oh, you did it, man! You're the best! Art.
Heart.
The end.
Performances, they're amazing, and I will treasure them forever. So, yay!